Coming up next on Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, we talk about holiday gift ideas, Valve confirms the Steam Box, and what not to do with WD-40. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 198, recorded on December 13th, 2012. The Valve Steam Box is confirmed. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Lantronics, maker of the XPrint server. Print from your iPad, iPhone, or any iOS device to virtually any printer. For more information, visit xprintserver.com/twit and enter the coupon code HOLIDAY2012 to receive 20% off your order. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, the show on the Twit Network where we, as the name says, we talk about computer hardware, talk about gaming, gaming hardware, all that kind of stuff. We have a good lineup for you today. Obviously, the person who's usually talking to you right now is Patrick Norton. He is out spending some time at a family event, so we wish him luck with that. But joining me as a guest in his place, our very own Josh Walrath. Josh, how are you doing?
Joining, but certainly not replacing. Plus, no, Patrick has far more hair than I do and makes a much more generous and interesting host.
Well, we'll skip the hair part and move on. Yes. Maybe he's more interesting. I don't know. Josh does a pretty good job. Josh is obviously one of the four primary cohorts on the PC Perspective podcast that we do at our website, pcper.com. So check that out. If at the end of this episode you decide you want to hear more from Josh. If not, move on and find someplace else. So let's go ahead and talk about some of the things that happened this week. It's holiday time. We're recording this. It is December the 13th. You've got less than 2 weeks for Christmas. So if you're trying to buy presents for somebody, tech presents, hardware gadgets, anything like that, you are quickly running out of time. Now, there are all kinds of gift guides everywhere. Everybody's got something. We have one up at pcper.com that has, three or four or five picks from all of our editors and news guys and all that kind of stuff. Feel free to glance around that. But I wanted to talk here. Maybe, Josh, we just pick one or two that really stand out. Like, what do you think is really interesting as a hardware-centric pick for this Christmas? What one kind of product or component stands out?
Oh, geez. Well, you had to, give me a hard one to talk about. I think right something away. That probably we have all agreed upon is the need for an SSD. We just had several new products coming out from Samsung, OCZ. I think Intel released a couple of updated versions. And the one that I had picked myself was the Samsung 840 Pro. This is the successor to the very popular and what was at the end of its lifespan a very affordable SSD, the 830. Yep. The 840 increases the performance, better IOPS, and it is a little bit more expensive now, of course. Instead of seeing a product around the $179 for a 256 gig drive, we're back up to about $269 with this particular product. What OCZ has the Vector, which is their first pretty much built from the ground up by OCZ. They had bought Indie Links a few years back, and this is the first native controller from OCZ. And the Vector, it has pretty much impressed everybody. We're looking at a price performance that is just right in the same ballpark as the Samsung 840. Alan, thought highly of it. I think pretty much every other review out there did. Yep. And the one thing that does cause a little bit of a pause is that OCZ's track record with firmware has been checkered at best. But it kind of looks like all indications point that this is a solid, solid product. And certainly it's one of the faster models out there, if not the fastest in most cases.
Yeah. It's an interesting product, and it's one of those things where you can't tell long term what a product's going to do. When you've had a review sample for a week or two or something like that. If I had to pick a particular product that stood out, You know, I really do. We were talking about pre-show in a couple of instances. I think the Trinity APU, the A10 5800K, that's the top end part, right, Josh? It's quad core up to 4.2 gigahertz with the turbo clock rates, but it also has higher performing integrated graphics than any of the Intel parts. And we were talking with Leo before the show started, and we were, you know, talking a little bit before here about how do you build the lowest cost gaming machine, mainstream gaming machine that you can, talking literally in the $300, $400 range. And this is the part you really kind of have to have to make that happen, because you need the best performing GPU for the lowest amount of money. And this, you know, you're, what is that part? $120 bucks.
Yeah. Yeah. It's inexpensive for what you get.
Yeah, and that's for your CPU and GPU, right? So that's kind of out the gate, right? And you can get a motherboard in the $50 to $60, $70 range. And then, you know, memory is dirt cheap. And if you can get away with not getting an SSD and get a hard drive, you can build a machine for really, really low, for a really low cost. And it's not, if you're doing media encoding, if you're doing video editing, if you're doing things where you're worried about CPU performance, it's not the best. And we would probably point you in the direction of an Intel Ivy Bridge part with a discrete card. But if you're looking to get, you know, really small form factor, really low power consumption, you know, the idea of the Steam Box, which we'll talk about a little bit later in the episode here, you know, the A10 5800K makes a good selection for that as well. And we had, if you look at the guide on PCBer, we had everything from screwdriver kits to particular game recommendations to this APU that we just mentioned, extended batteries for cell phones and that kind of stuff. That iFixit kit there is incredibly handy, especially if you had to be taking apart a Nintendo gaming system. It has the tri-wing bits and all the other stuff that you would expect.
And for $15 extra, you get the bundle of Saran wrap and scalpels.
Yeah,
so it'll be good for any situation.
I remember when I was looking up the collection of it, it's like all these spudgers, and I was like, I'm not quite sure I know exactly what a spudger is, so I'm going to go look. So you can see the spudgers there on the right, and you get a nice ruler as well. And then you got all kinds of different size tweezers and stuff on the left hand side as well. So, you know, if you like to take stuff apart, it's a great kit, and it's $60, something worth looking at. Now, the big story from this week, I think the one that's got the most attention, obviously, since we were talking with Leo before the show, anything that grabs his eye is something worth noting, is the kind of official confirmation of a Valve Steam Box, or that's just the name people are associating with, a Valve hardware solution. So at the VGA Awards, apparently Kotaku, which is a really big gaming website, got a chance to speak with Gabe Newell, who is, I don't guess he doesn't really have a title at that company, does he? He's just like the guy who
does pretty much everything, and he owns most of the shares.
Yeah. It was one of the first companies I knew of that did not have titles.
Like senior VP of accounting.
Right. Right. So when he introduces himself, he just says, "I'm Gabe, and I work at Valve," which is, I think, endearing in a lot of ways. But anyway, they got to talk with him, and we had been, even on This Week in Computer Hardware, talking about the rumors about Valve getting into the hardware business, what it would do, how they would go about doing it. And we saw all these little steps that Valve has taken along the way. Step one being the big, what do they call it? The big picture mode, right? And so this is like the 10-foot interface for Steam. It's where you can buy games. It's where you can access your games. It's where you can access your friends list, basically on a TV-style interface, an interface that you don't have a keyboard and mouse to, something that you use a controller, something that's 10 feet away, not like your regular computer screen type of deal. And that went into beta mode, I guess a year ago. I don't know. Maybe not that long ago. I don't remember what it was. But it was a while ago. And now it's finalized. It's in the full version of Steam. You don't have to go and enable it in any kind of developer settings or anything like that. It's out by default. We also saw Steam start to support non-game software. So you could download video editing and image editing software. You could download anything you want, basically. Any piece of software could be downloaded through Steam if that developer wanted to use it. So, you know, it kind of creates an app ecosystem outside of the Windows ecosystem, outside of Apple's ecosystem, but through Steam, because Steam is available on both PC and Mac. And then also the most recent thing, I guess, has been the Linux beta, where Valve released Steam on Linux. There are several games. I mean, actually, it's not several. There's a pretty big list.
More than a handful. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's not the newest, biggest name titles, but there are a lot of them in there, right? And it's a start, and it's just kind of in its infancy in terms of beta. And so Gabe, in this interview, says, these are a couple of quotes that I picked out. He, meaning Gabe, also expects companies to start selling PC packages for living rooms next year. Setups that could consist of computers designed to be hooked up to your TV and run Steam right out of the gate. So there, he's kind of foreshadowing that there's not only going to be maybe Valve getting in this market, but there's going to be other people getting this market. Whether, you know, we've seen some small PC vendors get into selling home theater PCs, but the whole idea of running Steam right out of the box, that it's meant to be hooked up to a TV, it's meant to be super simple, is a little bit new. And the other thing he said was, well, certainly our hardware will be a very controlled environment. He said, if you want more flexibility, you can always buy a more general purpose PC. For people who want a more turnkey solution, that's what some people are really going to want in their living room. So that obviously it was interesting because he basically said they have a solution. They're going to release a solution for living room PC, but it's going to be more controlled, which kind of goes against what we're used to seeing from Valve, right? They tend to be, when they created Steam, it was only their games at first, and they quickly kind of brought in the industry, and it is the most, I don't know how to best kind of explain it. It's not vibrant, is such a generic word, but it literally is the most vibrant ecosystem for PC software you'll find anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it has been a boon to indie game development, and certainly we've seen, you know, some really interesting titles that have come out just because they act as a publisher that's not a traditional publisher. I mean,
they're not controlling in that way. They don't take a huge cut of money.
I mean, they take the cut of money and all that, but they don't have to take a massive risk. Activision gets a game. They then want to say, well, not only do we want to do it on PC, but we need to have it on Xbox 360 and PS3. And so then you've got more development time to port them to that, and then they've got to print out all the discs, all of the packaging, all the marketing. And with Steam, an indie gamer, you know, gaming company comes up to him, signs an agreement, 30% cut or something for Valve, and they just put it up there, and it's just bandwidth. And I mean, they've got tons of bandwidth anyway. So it's they're kind of turning the industry around. But I think when we go back to a closed system, you know, I think that they're really going to optimize a lot of these games for this hardware level. Yeah, you can add a video card later maybe to build a beefier or PC to run this, but they're kind of setting a minimum target that you at least need to be able to run on this,
right,
and run on it stably. So I think that's what they mean about a little bit more control in terms of hardware, is they're trying to avoid the issue that we see with PCs everywhere, which, hey, I've got this combination of hardware and it causes a bug in this game. But at least with the Steam Box, they've got, you know, a baseline, and they've got, you know, some well set parameter of what the system is, what it's running. And, it makes a big, nice, easy target for a lot of these smaller gaming companies.
Well, what we don't know is, are they going to release a computer with integrated graphics? Are they going to release a computer with discrete graphics? Are they going to release several different versions of a system and say there's a $400 option, a $700 option, and a $1,000 option, right? We don't know any of those real details yet. I just, I think maybe what some people expected is to see a computer where you buy it from Valve and you just swap the card whenever you want. But that's obviously not going to be the case based on his statements there. So what do we expect kind of going into that and kind of flirting around the edges of controlled environments versus open environments? Because he says, if you want an open environment, you can just build another PC, which will still be the case, right? There will still be Steam that you can just install on your computer, which will probably be fine for most people. But it'll be interesting to see Valve enter the hardware market.
Yeah, I mean, the possibilities are endless. You buy a basic Steam box with an APU for $300. They'll sell you an upgrade card for $150 that's essentially a $120 video card, and you slap it in there. Drivers are already present with Steam Update, and you're good to go. So it's an interesting box that they are opening.
Okay, other interesting news that came out this week. We got a little bit more information about Haswell, the upcoming architecture from Intel. It's apparently going to be called the 4000 series of processors. No big surprise there. Core i3, i5, i7, 4000. Maybe a little bit surprising is that it will be called, the top end part will apparently be the 4770K, which should sound pretty familiar.
Very original.
Yeah, like the 3770K. And what's even more interesting is that the clock speeds are the same, or almost exactly the same. Like the base
clock, 3.5 base, 3.9
boost, 8 megs of cache, 2 core, 4 threads, DDR3 1666 support.
4 cores, 8 threads.
I'm sorry, you're right. 4 yes. cores, 8 threads, 2 channel memory. Maybe that's where I was thinking.
Yep.
But what is new is the graphics will be a little bit faster. They're calling it the Intel HD 4600 instead of the HD 4000. Actually, kind of made, just if I'm looking at naming structure, leads me to believe that it's not that much better, that maybe they just decided to keep the graphics in the same 4000s as the processors themselves. And then the TDP goes up a little bit from 77 to 84 watts. Now, despite the fact that it's the same clock speed, we still expect this part to be faster because the IPC should improve. The instructions per clock, the architectural changes should be improved. And probably, hopefully more dramatically than we saw from Sandy Bridge to Ivy Bridge. And the graphics should be increased pretty dramatically going from Ivy Bridge to Haswell as well. So I expect this to overall be a much better part. Josh, do you worry any that the TDP has gone up a little bit, or do you think that's kind of expected?
You know, it was expected because they're still working on Intel's 22 nanometer process. They probably improved the overall design, but you're not going to get anything for free here. To get the better IPC and performance, they're going to add transistors. They're going to add, you know, different structures in there. And with the big changes with the graphics portion, I mean, they really are starting to move forward and have, I mean, the jumps we've seen from the old Intel integrated graphics on their chipset to what we saw on the original, i5 series, it was the 800 series of processors, right?
Linfield.
Yeah, Linfield. And then with Sandy Bridge was a big improvement, and Ivy Bridge was yet again another improvement. You know, it's going to cost transistors to put a lot of these new features in, and to do that and to power it and to get it to not only match but improve upon performance. You know, they had a clock area that they wanted to hit, and plus we know that anything really above 4 gigahertz with Intel, you start hitting more heat issues and power draw with the 22 nanometer FinFET. So they're keeping it right around there. But yeah, 7 watts is not a huge jump. And we'll probably see overall maybe a 10 to 15% performance increase. So when you consider it's about 11% increase in wattage, and you'll get at least 15% in performance, Intel's moving the needle in the correct direction.
Yeah, moving the needle slowly, but at least moving the needle. Another area where Intel appears to be moving the needle is when they get prodded in competition in the server market. They announced this week a new line of Atom-branded server chips, the Atom S1200 line, which will compete against the upcoming ARM 64-bit parts, the ones we talked about that AMD was getting in on as well. This family of processors will be under 10-watt TDP, for the top line chip, which is the S1260, a dual core 2 gigahertz part that produces 8.5 watts. Three chips they've released. It's going to be released in the 32 nanometer process, according to this report on the EE Times. And new models upcoming soon will run on the 22 nanometer Tri-Gate technology. Intel has apparently not yet ruled out LGA models as well as the embedded chips you'll be seeing first. So that's kind of an interesting yes. twist on things.
Well, for the server market, they kind of need it.
Right.
People have different needs and wants,
this new market of micro servers. It seems kind of odd, right? So this is where you're trying to get as many individual CPUs in as small a space as possible. That the idea of an LGA socket definitely is counterintuitive in that regard, right? You know, if you solder them onto the board, you're gonna be able to get more stuff in a smaller space. I don't know. What do you think about this? You have any quick thoughts on the microserver world in general? This is obviously kind of a reactionary thing to all the press and discussion going around ARM-based servers, right? So, I mean, is there anything to take away from this, or is it just Intel again repurposing this architecture for some new cause?
We don't have the numbers of the actual servers sold. We don't know how many servers like SeaMicro even shipped using the previous generation Atom processors and their network fabric. But obviously Intel knows, AMD now knows, and if Intel sees that this is potentially a big area of growth, which I actually kind of believe it is, because we're at a point where CPU power is kind of insane, especially in our daily things that we do, and you don't always need a huge amount of it. So having this, you know, small 8-watt CPU running a couple, you know, what, 4 threads, and right. Able to handle a bunch of the, you know, cloud data, very basic web transactions, stuff like that, you don't need a whole lot of horsepower. So there's no real use to spend not only, you know, 125 watts for the CPU and then all the cooling that's involved with a higher end, you know, Xeon type processor. You can just, you know, slap in these inexpensive, server chips based on, I can't remember, it's a Clover Trail.
That's what's going in the new tablets, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And so it's essentially the same architecture. They call it else something different, of course, because there's code names are plenty and cheap. But yeah, I think it's it's an interesting move, and I think we're going to see a big growth in that. And a lot of little companies are probably going to have a server closet stuffed with these things and doing everything they need, and not have to pay not only bills for the power coming into it, but also the bills in cooling the entire thing.
So another company that knows about low power processors is VIA. And though we haven't heard from them in a while, there are rumors going on about a $99 Asus tablet. And with CES coming up in just a few weeks, that's a good chance we might see it there. And apparently this new rumor is that VIA is going to be the supplier of the ARM-based SoC in this platform. Josh, you have any thoughts on that?
It makes sense. ARM is out there for everybody. You can license out their designs, integrated into your own. VIA has a very long history of not just, you know, low power CPUs, but also the core logic behind, you know, motherboards. They have the S3 graphics guys already on board. All this technology can be not easily put in together, but they have all of the necessary pieces to make a compelling SoC. And in this case, they're using a last generation Cortex A9, which is still a very fast processor. It's not as fast as the A15 that we're starting to see with the Samsung Exynos products. But if the price is going to be right, again, it's an older technology. They slap everything all together and get it running and sell it for, you know, a couple of bucks a chip. You know, it's a couple extra million for the company. And I tell you, VIA could certainly use it. And it does bring up the question, what are they going to do with their wide range of x86-based patent portfolios? And these are all questions going forward. but it certainly looks like Arm has another feather in its hat.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and it seems obvious if you're making a $99 tablet, the most important part about any SoC that you put in it is price. And VIA may be looking to try to gain some foothold in this market, this very now getting very crowded ARM market. They might be the ones to offer up, you know, ASUS the best, just the best pricing in order to get into that $99 range if this happens to occur. But it is an interesting thing that it brings up about what is going to happen with the x86 license that VIA has. Are they going to abandon it, or are they just going to kind of keep running forward and just kind of like AMD is doing now, try to put one foot on each train platform and see where if you get split down the middle, because that's the only thing I can really see that would happen from this.
They're hoping that Hogwarts is real and platform what 9.5 is really there as they go heading towards the wall at full speed.
I'm not sure.
I don't know.
Finally, this is just worth noting for anybody that is an old school PC gaming fan like Josh and I. If you go to GOG.com, you can pick up Duke Nukem 3D for free as of this recording. I don't know when the special is going to end.
I think it ends the 14th, tomorrow.
Okay, so if you're watching live, go to GOG.com. Look up Duke Nukem.
Good it's free. Games.
It's look at the download size. It's 35 megs. I could literally down this in like 8 seconds on the internet connection that I have here. It's
game engine, audio stack, everything in 35 megs.
All the assets, all the textures, all the sound effects, 35 megs, released in 1996. And there's actually, it runs on Mac OS. Ken played this yesterday on his MacBook Air, which I thought was really funny. And we did do some tests to see if we could try to figure out how to tunnel it over a VPN so we could play it on a LAN after the podcast yesterday. But
not so good. This is an appropriate title for my children, right?
What's that?
Duke Nukem 3D.
Yeah,
good idea.
It does happen. Okay, so what was that? Were we gonna show a video? Compare Duke Nukem 3D to Duke Nukem Forever. Nice.
That's the horror.
Yeah, that's the classiness of Duke Nukem. It was funny when in 1996, when I was 14 years old, when you gave the stripper money. Now when you do it, now it's just kind of scummy when you do that in the new game. So we're going to do some email questions here. Interesting video. We're going to do some email questions. Before we do that, we have to thank today's sponsor, and that would be our good friends at Lantronics and their XPrint server. This is an interesting product. If you have any iOS devices, iPhone, iPod Touches, iPads, you have the capability to print things, kind of, as long as you have a printer that supports AirPrint, which is basically a standard that Apple created to help facilitate transfer over wireless networks. So it was just easy to print things. But there aren't a whole lot of AirPrint-enabled printers, and chances are you already have printers that work just fine, or the printer you do want doesn't have it. So how do you fix this? How do you go around that? Well, Lantronics has this device called the XPrint server. And all you do is you connect it up to your home network and all of your printers start working on your iOS devices automatically. It enables wireless printing from those same iOS devices, iPad, iPhone, iPod Touches. It eliminates the need to print through third-party apps. Like I have an HP printer, and it has an app that you can kind of print through, but you have to plan ahead that you're going to want to print something when you see it, which isn't always easy to do. So that it gets rid of that problem. You don't have to install any software. You don't have to email yourself documents. And it works with USB or network printers that you already own, whether it's wired or wireless. So it supports more than 4,000 top brand printers. It's easy to use, automatic discovery of these printers, and easy setup. It really is as simple as taking it out of the box, plugging in the network cable to your router, plugging in the power cable, and then let it detect your network printers. If you have a USB printer, you plug it into the USB port. And I think the Home Edition supports up to 8 USB printers and 2 network printers. So for $99, you can support up to 10 printers, which I think is going to be more than enough for most users. But you literally plug in the network and the power, and 30 seconds later, you can print to it. You don't have to go tell it what printer you're using. You don't have to tell it what port to use, what IP address to look at, none of that stuff. It does automatic detection for you out of the box. It supports multiple printers, unlimited iOS devices. So anybody that comes into your house that attaches to your network can print to your device if you let them. The Home Edition is $99, supports 8 USB and 2 network printers, like I said. Network Edition is $50 more and supports unlimited network printers. So that's more for offices that have a lot of printing that they need to get done. Good for your home or office, and it allows your USB printers, if you have just a plain old vanilla USB printer, to be shared with all users over the network. So it also kind of enables a print server functionality through the XPrint server as well. It's a really cool device. We have one here so that our iPad, iPhones, anything that people bring in can easily print to it. It was really, really super simple process to install. Now, how do you find out more about this? How can you get a great deal? If you go to xprintserver.com/twit, you can get more information and figure out how to buy one of these devices. It's a great idea if you're looking for a last-minute gift for an iOS user this holiday season. And we have a special offer. If you use the coupon code HOLIDAY2012, all one word, HOLIDAY2012, you get 20% off of your order. So that $99 XPrint server goes down to like $80, right? Now we're talking. XPrintServer.com/twit, and at checkout, use the coupon code HOLIDAY2012. And we thank Lantronix for the support of This Week in Computer Hardware and the entire Twit network. Now let's get to a handful of emails. Josh and I are going to figure out if we can help some people. First, I want to remind you that you need to send us emails. twitch@twit.tv. twitch@twit.tv is the email address for that. So make sure you send us any questions you have, hardware configurations, hardware compatibility, what system builds you want to build, if you have specific troubleshooting things. Sometimes we can help you out, or at least maybe find somebody who can in our audience as well. So let's jump into a couple of questions, Josh. I'm going to read this first one from Pip about a 21:9 monitor. I don't think we answered this one last week, so it was hit or miss on this, but I'll get your opinion on it either way. What are your thoughts regarding the new U2913WM 21:9 monitor by Dell? I was thinking of upgrading my single monitor at work to dual monitors, but it appears my Lenovo will only output to one display via DisplayPort. I can use VGA for the second monitor, but I generally hate the fuzziness that a VGA connection creates on most LCDs. Plus, I think a 21:9 monitor would look pretty badass at work. Do you think the extra wideness of a 21:9 monitor would be suitable instead of dual monitors? I haven't seen a 21:9 display in person. Also, I wasn't able to find any in-depth reviews about this display. Any chance you'll be able to review one? I have not seen one of these in person either. Have you, Josh?
No, I have not. I imagine we will see it at CES next month, though.
Yeah. So what's your opinion on this, on the 21:9 aspect ratio display?
I'm an Eyefinity user, mm-hmm. and I really like the space. And as humans, we do tend to work better in expanded horizontal spaces rather than, you know, larger vertical. I mean, we've gone from the standard 4:3 aspect as the standard, and now you can barely even find any of those aspect monitors,
right?
Because people prefer widescreen. Workspaces just seem to flow out a lot better. And then again, that's just us being hunter-gatherers that, you know, we're used to looking across the plains and looking for things to eat and kill. But anyway,
I mean, what do you think?
I don't know anything.
The resolution is 2560 by 1080. So mm-hmm. You're getting the equivalent of 1280 by 1080, which I don't think was ever actually it's essentially two 1080 by or 1280 by 1024 4:3 monitors.
Gotcha.
Wedged together into one display. First, I will say, yes, it probably does look badass on your desk at work. It would definitely stand out and look different. Yeah, and there's a good shot on our video feed of, you know, the ability to work on two things side by side. I think it would be – it's not – you know, I mean, you're talking – let's see. If I do just the raw math, 2560 by 1080 is 2.7 million pixels. But if you have, I don't know, now I'm just making stuff up. But you, if you have two 1080p monitors, you're looking at 4 million pixels. So if you look at pure pixels, you're going to get more out of two displays. I kind of agree with his sentiment about VGA connections not looking as sharp on modern displays. So I would maybe try to avoid that too.
I think it's a good compromise for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Having a monitor like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Single connection, 2560 by 1600. So, or 2560 by 1080. I imagine you still have to have dual link, which if he has a DisplayPort connection, that would, I assume, be good for that. It is an IPS panel as well. 60 Hertz, 8 millisecond, gray to gray. Should be pretty good. And it has USB 3.0,
hub
in it. Yeah. Which is nice.
Yeah.
Pretty sweet. So yeah, I would recommend trying it and maybe letting us know, right? Because I don't know if I'll be able to get one for a review anytime soon. So we could handle what you're.
I don't know. I think we do know somebody at Dell these days.
That's true. All right, I'll write him after the show.
Okay.
You want to read our next question here from?
I would love to read. Ack. Email from Ach. About graphics cards for everyday functions. I am not a gamer, but thinking of buying a low-end graphic card to improve my PC performance, like photo editing, HD vid, etc. Which one or what should I look for? Love your show, guys. But he's not talking to me. It's not
my
show.
New guy. Yeah, it happens.
I'm not offended, though. So, boy, how is GPU stuff going?
See, Open I don't even CEO. Know... not great. Like, I don't feel confident about recommending a GPU for photo editing really at all. It's not necessary. It's just, I mean, he doesn't tell me what CPU he has. You know, if you're doing HD video editing in Adobe Premiere, then I would start thinking about what GPU you're going to use, right? Because that their media encoding engine can take advantage of GPUs. And if you're doing a lot of HD video at once, but you have to be doing a lot of HD video at once for it to really matter. We get this type of question a lot. Like, I don't do much with my computer. What kind of graphics should I use? If you're using an Ivy Bridge part, you could probably just use the integrated graphics, right? You can
especially if you're not a gamer. So
yeah, if you're not a gamer, and you're not doing like super high-end audio video production where the GPU compute's really going to matter. You know, if you've got a quad-core hyper-threaded Ivy Bridge, you know, 3770 or even the quad-core 3570 without hyper-threading, I have no issues telling people at this point to go ahead and use integrated graphics. And if you start to game, that's a totally different story. But yeah.
You know. And if you're really heavy into this stuff, then you're going to be buying like a Quadro card anyway.
Right. Right.
So,
all right. Let's see if we got time for a couple more. We've got one from Andrew about a higher end GPU. This might be a more interesting discussion. Love a good PC enthusiast show. I have serious graphics card dilemma. I'm in the process of rebuilding my AMD Phenom X4 Media Center PC. Yeah, I know it's a power guzzler. Into my dedicated PC first person shooter gaming rig and putting my nice shiny EVGA GTX 670 SC into it. Bigger dilemma is what to put into my main rig, a new 680, another 670, or even 660 Ti. I will be playing my simulation games like SimCity on the desktop, Diablo and some random games, as well as Premiere, Photoshop, 3D modeling. Need your advice badly. What would you guys do in the main desktop rig graphics option? So it looks to me like he is going to put a 670 into his Phenom X4 PC, if I'm reading this right. And then now he needs a new GPU to put into his primary machine. That's a pretty big graphics card to be putting into your secondary machine.
If money's not an object, just go with a 680.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it doesn't sound like money is a big concern if he's already got the 670. Maybe just generalizing some, but you don't want to go lower than the 670, especially. Because you don't want to lower your graphics performance from what you're used to. So you need to either get another 670 or you need to go up to the 680. But the funny thing is he's talking about playing Diablo in SimCity, which you do not need a 674 even in that case. You know, the new SimCity.
Diablo's pretty can be rough at times.
Yeah, it can, but you don't need a 6 unless he's doing iFinity type stuff or NVIDIA Surround or something like that. Not neither there. If I were you, I would say go with another 670. You can get those significantly cheaper than a 680. And if you look around and find them on sale, you can get them pretty close in price to a 660 Ti as well. So just a thought.
Yeah.
You want to take our next one here from Zach?
I would love to take the next one from Zach. Email from Zach about laptop noise. I recently replaced the stock hard drive with an SSD, and I love it. Over the past 6 months, it has become kind of noisy. The fans make it sound like an old crappy car. I am hesitant to open it up to investigate the cause, since laptops are intimidating and complex inside. But if it's just in need of WD-40, I would like to do it myself for free. Any advice would be appreciated. Here is a video of exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh, did I not include the video?
You didn't include the video.
Didn't include the video. You ever taken apart a laptop to get to the fan?
No, but it's not always an easy process.
Yeah, sometimes getting, he didn't say exactly what kind of laptop it is. Getting to the fan, like if you're going to replace the memory or maybe the hard drive,
that's on easy. Laptop,
piece of cake. I can walk you through that. Depending on the laptop, where the fan is, how you access it. I don't know if it's a CPU fan or if it's just a typical standard exhaust fan. I would probably recommend. Would you recommend not using WD-40 inside your laptop case?
Yeah, you don't probably want to do that because that it's a solvent. It's a solvent.
Okay, all right.
And yeah, PCBs and solvents may not always mix well.
I don't know what to tell you on this. I would say look up your laptop, see if you can find anybody that has directions on how to take it apart, has maybe done this before. Do not spray WD-40 inside. Like if you can see the fan looking through the grill, don't just like, oh, I'll get it and just spray WD-40 inside it. Unless it's really old and you're just hoping it doesn't, you know, if you're okay if it dies, but I don't think it is if you just put an SSD inside of it. Look for directions. If you're creative, if you have that iFixit toolkit, maybe try to take it apart. See if you can replace the fan. It's going to be hard to do. Or maybe get the fan and try to put some grease on it or something like that. That's not going to be a solvent and or put WD-40 on it very carefully or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's hard to do, which it's hard to deal with anything like that in a notebook. You know, like how do you replace the screen in a notebook? It really depends on the brand that you're using and how complicated it is and how expensive those extra parts are. And it's like junking a car, like an older car. Is it worth fixing or is it worth buying a fan? You know, obviously it's a different story.
Or just put a rag in the gas, you know, in the gas cap.
Light it and run.
Yes.
All right. I think we'll do one more email and let's do this one. It's kind of in the same vein as fans. This is from Vic. He says, I bought several Cougar Vortex 120mm 4-pin PWN case fans, and to my horror, they all make this loud, high-pitched coil whining noise when running below 100% RPM. It makes my head want to explode. Now, is it the fan's fault or the motherboard or both? The fan doesn't make this whining noise when using 3-pin voltage control to adjust RPM. Reading Newegg's customer reviews, it seems to be a mixed bag. Some people have had this problem while others hear nothing. Tested with a Cooler Master 120mm PWM fan, and it did produce a very subtle whine or click, but nothing compared to the Cougar Vortex. Now, I'm assuming you don't have any experience with these exact fans, Josh, but what do you know about the 3-pin versus 4-pin motherboard fan solutions?
I thought the only difference between 3-pin and 4-pin is that the extra pin is a way to measure RPM, kind of a feedback into that, and then it adjusts the power to either spin it up or spin it down. And
right,
three pins are just, you know, power, ground, and one other thing I can't remember. But anyhow, it sounds like it's an issue rather with the fans than a motherboard.
I don't know anything about this brand of fan, the Cougar Vortex. I don't really know. And this could. I don't think it's the motherboard. He doesn't mention the motherboard. But if you put in another fan and you don't hear the same thing, that's a problem. A lot of this is very subjective as well. One fan's noise might be really grating to you, to Vic here, but not to me, or vice versa. And it's one of those, kind of like it used to be with power supplies, you know, 5, 6, 7 plus years ago, where everybody just bought the cheapest ones because they thought, it's a power supply. People tend to do that with case fans today still. They kind of go, it's a fan, it moves air, whatever, doesn't need to do anything. But when you get high quality fans, like the new ones from Corsair, some of the Antec ones that are designed to be quiet, they're designed to run at you know, these variable voltages and that kind of stuff, that it can make a really big difference. They're not always cheap though, but it can make.
Well, he should just, you know, cut to the chase and just get a bunch of those, you know, 50 millimeter Delta fans.
Yeah. Yeah.
And run them at, you know, 10,000 RPM.
It seems to me that since he says that noise doesn't happen at 100% RPM, like if you turn it all the way up, that it's probably in the fan. It's probably something in the electrical components of the fan where, you know, you get this sometime with ceiling fans, right? Where when it's on the low setting and it's not creating enough wind noise to cover it up, you can hear the electrical coil itself. Yeah. And that can be really frustrating. It's probably what's happening here. And maybe at 100%, that's still happening, but the noise of the air movement is actually drowning it out at the same time. So I don't know. I think if you can return these fans and try some different ones, you never know. Sometimes combinations of particular electronic components with other electronic components just don't agree necessarily. Mm-hmm. And I would try a different brand, try a different type. So
yeah, they're not real expensive. You still hate to waste money, but $13 to $15 is a lot better than,
yeah,
I don't know, buying an Xbox 360 game for $59.
Yep. Yeah. All right, everybody. That is going to wrap up our show for this week. Again, if you have any questions, please let us know. Twitch, TWICH at twit.tv. And if you're looking for back episodes, you want to help some people, other people subscribe and spread the word about the show, it's twit.tv/Twitch, twit.tv/Twitch. And we do record the show live on Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern, there or thereabouts most weeks, but that's the place to go to catch all of our episodes, twit.tv/Twitch. Patrick should be here back next week. We'll have the normal cast and crew, unless I decide to bow out, and then Josh can fill in for me. We have some cool
Cincinnati
stuff
playing again on next Thursday.
No, I know.
UK game?
No, they only play on Saturdays for the next couple of weeks. Yeah. See, but good looking out. Good looking out.
Hey, trying to help you out.
On PCPer.com, which is where you can find both Josh and I the majority of the time, we have some cool stuff coming up. I finally have, as I reach across the table, a review of this going up, the Intel Nook, tomorrow. This is a 4-inch by 4-inch by 2-inch computer, basically built on Ultrabook hardware. But it's a desktop. It's got VESA mounts and some other interesting things. And then also Ken finished an article on a Hackintosh build that we completed today, and how surprisingly easy it is to build when you plan a little bit ahead and you make sure you get all the right hardware and that kind of stuff. So keep an eye out for that all this week. Well, I guess next week by the time you listen to this. So, hey, Josh, thanks again for filling in, buddy. It was good to see you.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right, everybody.
It's nice to be back on Twit.
It is. It's always nice. It's always nice.
Yes.
All right, everybody. We'll see you guys next week on Twitch. Come on, Bengals. Stop sucking.
Are they losing?
No, but we went up 10-0 quickly, and now it's 10-10.
Oh, that does suck. Who's QB for Eagles today?
Foles. They said Foles was going to start for the rest of the season. I'm going to talk with the tree, like, here.
Oh, it's so cute. One just by my door, and then I don't know where I got the other one.
Thank you, Ken K Rally or King Crowley 20. It's a tiny Christmas tree from MSI. It's really hard to see. Yeah, there you go. If I point the fiber optics at the camera,
see, you can see the light.
It's color shifting. It's magic.